So welcome to the new term. To this new mini series. Before we begin, it's been all over the WhatsApps and so, but I just want to just to make sure people understand what we're going to do. This term is a little bit different. Instead of doing long series, we're going to just do a few short series. So this one is for 2 weeks. Let me see if this works. That's better. Then there's another three series. So 7th and 14th of August, we're going to do a 2 week series on the Kabbalah of animals. Something different. I'm going to have to work hard for it, but it's okay. It's good. I don't like animals. So. Sorry?
What did you say? Kabbalah of?
Animals. So it should be interesting, but also be personal growth orientated, so the lessons we can learn and so on. Then the 21st and 28th of August, we're going to have a 2 week series on moral and ethical dilemmas. And then a short series after that on festival symbols. I just need to tell you, I know it's far away still, it's not going to be about apple and honey because I think we've developed quite a lot of research on that. But there's lots of other symbols that people do and don't know why or don't know the depth of why, so we're going to explore that. Okay. So, many years ago, I don't know how many years ago it was, we did a series on relationships. I mean, we've done relationships off and on, but we did a series on healthy relationships and communication. And one of those series was called Relate, if you remember. Right? Actually, we're going to test if you remember in a second. Right? The reason why it was called Relate is because Relate was an acronym. Does anyone remember what it is? Anyone remember what it stands for? And if you don't, you can just tell me what you think we need in order to make a strong relationship or a strong relationship stronger. Any relationship. Anyone?
Trust,
okay.
Inequity.
It's actually, trust is not in there. It's
a good one.
But it's a good one, yes.
Respect.
Listening.
Respect.
Respect, right. So, very good. So the R stands for respect. So it was actually in order. I had to fit it into the word relate, so we played around a little bit with it, but that's what it was. It was empower. Respect was first, because respect is the beginning. Respect comes before love. Empowering each other, love, ask, which is listening, talk, which is communication, and then enjoy. And we talked a lot about the emphasis of respect coming before love, because love can be selfish love or selfless love. And in order to make sure that it's selfless love, actually respect comes before love. And listening comes before talking. You can only really listen, you can only really talk to someone else and talk to their world and connect to the world if you do a lot of listening first. So that's what we did a number of years ago. Now, a few things. First of all, just because we did this a few years ago doesn't mean we can't revisit the concepts, because relationships always, all relationships need ongoing work, ongoing investment, and we always need to re-listen. I know I had this myself with parenting. I'm sure some of you did this too. I used to love to go to parenting talks. Not every week, but I used to go every so often, because you always hear new things, or you hear things that you always knew but have forgotten about, right? It's interesting. I just got some feedback like that to us. On Monday was a school free day. I did an in-service for a school in Melbourne, actually, on Zoom. And the feedback was positive. They said that it was very helpful. And they said even the things that they'd heard before about the particular topic, it needs to come to the forefront again. And that's why we revisit topics every so often. But it's more than that, because for some reason relationships have declined, which was very surprising to me. I looked it up. I thought we'd solved the whole problem when we did the last series, but apparently in the world at least, I actually did a bit of research. I've been playing around with, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, I don't know. I've been playing around with AI, ChatGPT. Don't worry, the next article is still my ideas, okay? It's not ChatGPT's ideas. I'm not asking for their ideas. I'm asking sometimes just for, you know. But they're very good for research. It's actually quite an unbelievable tool, I have to say, on a serious note. So I asked them about, has relationships been declining? And they gave me this whole spiel, like seven things, I think, of why. No, eight things. I don't know what it was. Lots of things. Rising individualism, technology, communication, expectations have changed, mental health challenges, all kinds of stuff, right? But it has been, and therefore we really need to look at why. And all those things that AI gave me was very nice, but actually I don't think they got to the core of the issue. And that's what I want to do. I really want to actually take it a lot deeper than we did last time. It will be similar ideas, but nevertheless still to get to the core of why it's hard to respect sometimes. Why, or what do we need? What's the cause of disrespect or selfless love? Sorry, selfish love versus selfless love and so on. That's what I want to try and do today and next week. Today will be more theoretical. Next week will be more practical. So let's just briefly revisit some of the foundations. First of all, we know that most of the human experience is relationships. What do I mean by that? Give me some examples. Not the regular ones. I know marriage, parenting, besides that. Sorry?
The workforce.
Workforce, exactly. Employer, employee.
Teacher,
student.
Children, school.
Children, sorry?
Discipline with children.
Yeah, yeah. Children, parents and children, for sure.
Friends. How do you communicate with people generally?
Just generally. Like, but I'm saying, what type of, like, it can be anything. Something working in your house, your plumber, your clean lady, could be. It's also a relationship. It's a connection. A different type. Obviously, every relationship is different. Every relationship has different features and different definitions and different criteria to make it work. But fundamentally,
Interactions
with people, exactly. Especially ongoing interactions, right? Siblings, relatives, whatever they are.
With yourself.
Yes, true. true. Although we shouldn't be too carried away with ourselves. I think that's part of the issue. As we know. And as Viktor Frankl speaks about a lot. But it is true, by the way. having a relationship with ourselves is important, but actually it's strengthened when we have good relationships with other people, as we're going to see. So we know that relationships are critical for human experience. Right? So the whole day works around relationships. And the more relationships we have, the better. Even interactions, I've mentioned this before, there's research that even informal and just off-the-cuff interactions you have with people you don't even know, like people you meet in a lift or at a bus stop, if you have those interactions, which now is very rare because everyone's looking at their phone, but if you're able to have them, there's actually research that it increases longevity, funnily enough, right? So if you want to live long, next time you go to the bus stop, put away your phones and start talking to people. Just ask them about the weather. Okay. But generally speaking, human relationships is very, very critical. Why? Why? Tell me. Why are they so critical? If I'm self-sufficient and I go live on a mountain somewhere.
Because it makes you think about someone else.
Makes you think about someone else. Okay, but why is that so important? Sorry? Okay, maybe prevent self-absorption, correct?
We're not meant to be islands.
We're not meant to be?
Islands.
Islands, yeah, but why? Why? The fact that we're not allowed to be islands is 100% correct. But why? We need to think about why.
It's good for your well-being. You need to extend yourself.
Okay, loneliness is one. Right, loneliness is one, for sure. Because the way God designed us is that in order to nurture ourselves, in order to develop, we need connection. And that is what we've spoken about this before, what it says right in the very beginning of the Chumash, when God created Adam, he said, Lo tov v'yota Adam levado, it's not good for the person to be alone, or Rabbi Soloveitchik famously translated it, not to be alone, but to be lonely, right? Because relationships doesn't mean you have to be talking to people all day. I mean, some people like that, and that's fine, but it means you have to have connections, right? And also, I think the other reason is, the famous idea that the Talmud says that God built the world, he designed the world based on the concept of chesed, to give, like you said, to give to others. And for giving, there needs to be giving and receiving. And therefore, every relationship needs to be giving and receiving. can be anything. It can be emotional stuff. It can be intellectual ideas. It can be giving things, depending on what the relationship is. It can be financial support, whatever it is. But the world, otherwise the world would be a selfish world. This is the famous story that I've mentioned many times in the Talmud, where someone asked a heretic, challenged one of the great Talmudic rabbis, and he said, if God can provide, why doesn't he just provide for everyone, whatever they need? And he's famously answered, because then it wouldn't be a kind world. There needs to be mashpia and makabel, giving and receiving. Anything, doesn't, right? Now, just in parentheses, it's both things need to be worked on. We've talked about this. We need to learn how to give. We also need to learn how to receive sometimes. In fact, my son and I talked about this on this week's JP podcast. If you want to listen to it, it's a reflection on the twins. And it came in this idea of giving and receiving. But it doesn't mean that we need to be takers. It's a Jewish value not to be a taker and to try and be independent. But that's very different. To be needy is not a good thing. But we all need to receive and to facilitate giving, because there cannot be giving without receiving. Now, what that means, therefore, okay, so again, we want to do away with isolation and loneliness. We want to have connection. And we also want to be able to give and receive, right? Which means the following, therefore. It means that every relationship and everything that happens in a relationship must foster those two things, right? It's got to foster and it's got to enhance one or both of these things, connection. So everything that we do in a relationship has got to be strengthening connection. And also, it's got to be in the context of giving and therefore receiving as well. Right? So that always has to be a giving component to it. That's critically important. Now, here's the... Oh, sorry. I haven't done this for a while, so I need to get used to it still. Okay. So here's the real issue. And this is the foundation that I want to sort of explore a little bit, right? To have a healthy relationship that will foster connection and giving, you need two things. You need negation of ego, okay? Negation of ego, and a sense of self. They sound opposite, but you need them. You need negation of ego and you need a sense of self. Now, let's understand why you need a sense of self. Anyone? Why do you have a good sense of self in a relationship? To have a healthy relationship.
You have to have self-respect.
Why? I mean, yes, but why? I mean, I'm in a challenging mood, okay?
Because you can't give back if you don't give.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah?
If you don't feel good about yourself, you can't. If you extend yourself, you can't give up yourself.
Correct.
You also have to recognize your own shortcomings.
Correct. All that, right? You have to have a good self-awareness of yourself. But I think this all relates to a very core issue. A definition of a relationship is a connection between two individuals, between two people, between two different people who have a unique contribution to make and something to bring that the other one doesn't have. If you disappear, if you dilute in a relationship, then it's not a relationship, right? And no one wants that. No one wants to be married, for example, to a non-existent person, figuratively speaking, symbolically speaking, right? Presence of self in the relationship, both people, whatever the relationship is, presence of self is a very important thing. That's why many years ago, when we talked about this, we talked about respect. Part of respect means valuing the individuality of the other person. But the other person's also got to have that individuality. The problem, however, is not the problem, the challenge, I should say, right? Is that you all of this, if there is a good sense of self and there's a negation of ego, it'll contribute to the collective growth. It'll be a healthy relationship, a strong relationship. But we need to discuss why negation of ego is so important, and also we need to understand that all of this cannot happen if there's an ego. So we need to understand how that balances out. How do we do that? How do we have a strong sense of self without an ego, right? So let's talk about ego. Let's just understand why ego is so destructive. So ego essentially, I mean, we could talk a lot about ego, but ego essentially means, right, not making space for another person. It's a self-absorption and it's a It's a sense of always pushing me and myself to the point that I make little or no space for other people, right? Where does it come from? It normally comes from a gross insecurity, right? It comes from gross insecurity. The need to spread out. I've told you the story many times. There was a great rabbi called the Tzemach Tzedek, and someone came to him, a follower of his came, and he said, "Rabbi, I don't know what to do. When I go to shul every morning, everyone's stepping on me, figuratively speaking, right?" And he said, "Well, if you wouldn't spread yourself out in the whole shul, then maybe people wouldn't step on you." Simple. So it comes to that insecurity of I need always to be in everyone's face because I'm insecure by myself, right? The problem is, and this is the problem, right? Things that are critical to relationships cannot happen when there's an ego. Because if a strong ego, because when there's an ego, there can't be real respect, right? Can't have respect for someone else if everything's about you. The whole point of respect is valuing someone that's outside of you. If you are everywhere, then there's no respect. You can't have real empathy, right? Because what is empathy? Empathy means that you're able to look, not just to look, you're able to see deeply into another person. You're able to notice another person. You're able to notice their pain, their happiness, their emotional turmoil, their healthy emotions, their happy emotions, whatever it is. You're able to put yourself into them. You can't put yourself into them if you're everywhere. I just saw an unbelievable story, like an extreme empathy, but an extreme humility at the same time, right? Just recently, there's a story that happened recently. There was a small yeshuv, a small town in Israel. I don't know the details, but this is how the story goes. Because it was told by someone who's a rabbi in that community. And he said, thank God, he said, since the war started, that particular community in his shul or his little environment, whatever, many parents have children in the army, and till recently, thank God, there was no deaths from their children in the army. And then a number of weeks ago, there was. Because, you know, recently, unfortunately, there's been many injuries and deaths. So a soldier was killed, was from that community. A few weeks later, a second death happened in the same community. So the second person just got the news. And when the news started to spread, the first bereaved father came running. Because he understood, obviously, what it's like. And he came running just to see that the second person is okay. And as he came into the room, the second one looked up and said to the first one the following. He said, I didn't want to be, nor did I choose to be in this club. But he said, now that I am, I can really feel your pain. Are you okay? That's the ability to see someone else, even in intense pain, right? There can't be real giving either. There can't be compassion, can't be compromise, and there can't be real giving. Why can't there be real giving? Sometimes people give, but they give what's good for them. They give for their own agenda. They give to make them feel good. They give what they think needs to be given. Real giving means to really see the other person, right? To be able to see what the other person needs. So all of these things really can't happen unless there's a tempered ego. If there's a strong ego, a strong self-absorption, all these things can't really happen, and all these things are critical for relationships. There has to be compassion, there has to be empathy, there has to be respect, there has to be giving. So all those things can't really happen. Right? Let's just take this a step further. So therefore, what we need to do is, we need to work on that ego. So in Jewish writings, the Hasidic writings in particular, we have this thing called bittul. It's a Hebrew word, bittul. Hard to translate. Sometimes people translate bittul as, I don't know, self-nullification, self-negation. It means all of that. But essentially it means it's like self-negation. Sounds horrible, but it really means to kill our ego, to temper our ego, right? Sorry, can I just ask you to press the button? It's getting very hot in here. Right.
Shady would prefer.
Sorry?
With empathy, Shady would prefer not to turn off
the ego. We'll
turn it back on when it gets cold. Yeah, don't worry.
What's it worth to you?
No, we're not going to leave it cold, God forbid. I have to one day learn how to get the setting right, you know, so it'll just be good the whole time. Okay, anyways. So, there's the concept of self-negation. There's such a concept, right? Of actually creating a sense where we just start to realize it's not about us. We have to surrender, particularly in a religious context or Hasidic, Kabbalistic concept. We surrender to God. We know that we really, in the scheme of things, just a very, very insignificant being. In the scheme of everything, God is infinite, and we're just a very finite, mortal human being. We're not so great like we think we are. Nor did we create ourselves, even though some of us sometimes think so, but we didn't create ourselves. Our success, our achievements have to do with God-given gifts and God-given talents. All of that stuff, right? To minimize the ego. And at the same time, as we just said before, God created us with a self. And he wants us to use that self. Right? So again, it's how do these two things come together, and how do we manage them both together? And going back to relationships, that ego will, if your person has such an ego, it's going to prevent everything. And yet, as we said before, you can't be married to a no one, or you can't have a relationship with a no one, or you can't be a no one. And therefore the sense of self and the sense of unique contribution is very, very important. So I want to share with you a formula. I don't think I've ever shared this here, but it's the formula which I call the formula of Jacob's sheep. It'll become clear in a few minutes, don't worry. So we have a story in the Torah where Jacob runs away from his family because his brother Esau was pursuing him and wanted to kill him and so on. So he left and he went to the town of Haran, where he had an uncle there. His uncle was Lavan, and his uncle had two daughters, Rachel and Leah, and he ended up marrying them and so on. But when he was in there, and then he had 11 of his 12 of his 13 children actually had there in Haran. So the Jewish family essentially was born in Haran. That was the establishment of, we call ourselves Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael is the children of Israel, because Yaakov had a second name, Yisrael. That's where it comes from. And we are Bnei Yisrael. And Bnei Yisrael essentially was born, created, and established in Haran. Okay. Yaakov was there for 20 years. For 7 years, I'm telling you the biblical story. 7 years he worked for his first wife. And then he got tricked and he got Leah instead of Rachel. You know the story. Then he worked another 7 years for Rachel. And then he was doing really well. And Lavan was extremely happy because a blessing had come to the house. Every time since Yaakov had arrived, Lavan was becoming very prosperous. So therefore he really wanted to keep his son-in-law there. So he kept him for another 6 years and he offered him to work for another 6 years. What was Yaakov's wages? Sheep. Because Lavan was, sheep, that's what he had. So his whole thing is to get a certain percentage of the sheep to be his own. It was a whole story at the end. They made a deal that they would, there's a whole Kabbalistic thing behind it, but just a simple story that Lavan told him, you know, a certain color of sheep will be yours, if it's spotted or dotted or whatever. The whole story was sheep. Bottom line is, Yaakov amassed an amazing amount of sheep. Okay. What do you do with his sheep? The rabbis tell us. He became a wealthy man. He used some of the sheep to sell. He bartered them for other animals, for donkeys, for oxen, for all kinds of things, servants, maidservants. He became a wealthy man, all from the sheep. Okay. Then, eventually, after 20 years, he leaves Lavan, and he's on the way back. And on the way back, he knows that he still has a brother back home, Esau, who was really upset with him because he stole the blessings and the whole story, and he wanted to kill him, and he really was concerned. Maybe Esau hasn't forgotten, and Esau hadn't forgotten. So he sends messengers to Esau to feel him out. Very respectful message, he said, and he tells his messengers, tell Esau the following. He said, "Im Lavan garti, I've been living with Lavan for many, many years. And when I was in Lavan, vayihi li shor v'chamor," hence the second picture, "I amassed oxen and donkeys, servants, maidservants." In the middle of the sentence, he also slips in sheep as well. Right? Now, every word in the Torah we know is exact. There's always a lesson in everything, right? So the commentators ask the question like this. First of all, why did God design it in such a way? Well, that Jacob went to Lavan and for 20 years, his entire business structure was all around sheep. And yet, when he sends a message to Esav, right? When he sends a message to Esav, he doesn't start with sheep. He doesn't say, you know, I went to Lavan for 20 years, I got so much sheep. No, he starts with the other things that he got, that he bought with sheep. He got donkeys, he got oxen, and so on and so forth. So the Lubavitch Rebbe once in a talk offered the following idea, a very fundamental idea. He said like this, in Kabbalah and in Hasidic teachings, every animal, we haven't got to the serious animals yet, but We'll slip it in now. Sheep is a symbol of humility. Sheep follow. Sheep is a symbol of surrender. Sheep is a symbol of ego negation, as we've talked about before. Right? It's a symbol of the word we used before, a symbol of bittul. Bittul. Right? The foundation has to be ego negation. That's the foundation. His entire fortune was based on the, not entire fortune, the entire foundation of Am Yisrael is based on sheep. We surrender to each other. We don't take ourselves seriously. We try to work on not having an ego, because that just stands in the way of everything negative, everything positive, I mean. And then we surrender to God ultimately. The ultimate relationship is a relationship with God, right? But with that sheep, Yaakov bought other things. He bought other things that don't symbolize humility. Not that they're in contradiction with humility, but they symbolize strength. Like oxen, like donkeys, stronger animals, firm animals. So therefore, Yaakov, with the sheep, buys other things that symbolize strength, not humility so much. They symbolize more the ability to be firm, the ability to be strong, the ability to fight even. Right? All those kind of things which are symbolized with the other animals. And Yaakov, when he comes to Esav, he doesn't start with the sheep. And the Rebbe explains the following. He says like this. The starting point has to be bittul. It's not about how these two things are balanced. It's not about balance. It's about how we build the building. The foundation of our building, of our relationship building, is humility. Sheep. That's the foundation. Where we are secure enough to make room for another. We secure enough not to take ourselves so seriously. We secure enough not to be obsessed the entire day with ourselves. I know this is not, in today's society, unfortunately, it's not kind of the ongoing theme, but nevertheless, right, this is the truth. That's what the foundation is. Then, however, God wants us to use our strength as well when necessary. For example, when Yaakov comes and he has to meet an Esav, you don't come like a, you know. I want you to know, I've been 20 years by Esav. By Lavan. And you know what I did? I bought oxen, donkeys. Like, let's not talk about the sheep now. The sheep is my foundation. And I bought sheep also because that's what drives everything in my life. But I can be strong when I need to be. I can be firm when I need to be. I can be assertive when I need to be. And it's not only with an enemy like Esav, it's with each other. Sometimes we need to be strong in relationships. Sometimes we need to be firm. Sometimes we need to have tough conversations. Sometimes we need to do things that are hard. Sometimes we need strength. Particularly in relationships which we have more influence, like parents and children, teachers and students, right? It's not all about being humble. It's not all about, like today, what they call gentle parenting, which is a lot of rubbish, right? Sorry, I mean. No, it just is, I mean. We'll do another series on it one of these days. Huh? No, it is. It's just complete nonsense. We shouldn't be harsh with, no, because what is important is to have this.
Parents to attend
it. Yeah, yeah, no. Okay, if you help me put a parenting course together, we'll do it. Partnership. Okay. So, why? Because sometimes we need to be strong and sometimes we need to be firm in all relationships. And also we need to use ourselves. That's be a sense of self. When we go into a relationship, we have something to offer that is unique, that the other person can't offer. That's what giving and receiving is all about, right? And we have to not hide it. We must use. God gave us talents, use them. He gave you an ability to do something, use it. Have a sense of self. But it's got to be bought by the sheep. It's acquired by the sheep. It's in the context of the sheep. It's in the context of humility. What does that mean? I'll give you an example. Let's take a character. We've talked about this before, but let's take a character trait of ambition. Right? I use this example because ambition is quite a self thing. Like, I'm ambitious. I want to achieve, right? Okay. Is ambition bad or good? It depends. It's very simple. Ambition is good because it develops my success, develops what I'm able to do. But number one, the question is it based on values or based on selfishness? And this is in the context of ego or is it in the context of negation of ego, right? In other words, when I'm ambitious and I'm trying to do something, am I including others or am I breaking others in the process? Many people in the world are very ambitious and they destroy everyone and everything in their way to achieve their goal. In other words, the ambition is completely egocentric. Right? Well, the question is, if you are ambitious, which is a good thing, ambition is a good trait. By the way, in the six, the two triangles of the thing, it's called netzach, right? Victory, ambition, winning, overcoming obstacles, being ambitious. But, well, it's going to harm other people. It's going to come with some self-awareness about what you are able to do, not able to do, with some humility. Right? Can I take feedback from other people? Like, is there humility in my ambition that when I'm trying to achieve what I think I can achieve, I might be able to, I might have to take some bit of criticism from other people in a constructive way? Which is doesn't fit in with self, right? That's a conflict with self almost, but it's not really. And the way it works is like in ambition, in the example of ambition, right? That when ambition comes in the context of humility, I get other people to help me. If it comes in the context of humility, I don't shy away from feedback, from criticism, from constructive criticism, which will be helpful. And in fact, what's going to be the result? A stronger sense of self. Because I'm actually going to be able to really exercise my ambition. That self, that positive self that God gave me, which I need to use, but now it's not built on my insecurity and my insecure egocentricity, it's actually going to end up better. Because we work together and I hear from other people and I get confident. I don't hurt other people in the way. My ambition is based on values. I help other people. I lift up other people. I give up. I make space for someone else to come with me on the ambition journey, right? Where do we find a story like this in the Torah? Just the weekly Pasha that we had a few weeks ago. There was a gentleman who rebelled against Moses and his brother Aaron called Korach. Famous story in the Chumash, right? Sorry, Korach. And there's a famous question. And the whole story is told, and him and his family and all the people he brought with him actually were very severely punished by God, and they were swallowed up in the ground, right? And there's a famous question of why name an entire weekly portion of the Torah, each parasha has a name, why do we name it after Korach? He wasn't a good guy. It's not nice to call a whole parasha with Korach. And again, some of the explanation goes like this, a beautiful idea. Because Rashi brings, the commentator Rashi says that Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to explain to Korach that you're ambitious. There's nothing wrong with ambition. But ambition has to be with awareness and humility. It's got to come from that. It's got to come with the humility that I have a talent that God gave me and I want to try and reach it. An aspiration. Aspiration is a good thing. But you also need to know not all the time could you achieve it. And Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses said to Korach an amazing thing, because one of the things Korach wanted to do, God had appointed one high priest, Moses' brother, Aaron HaKohen, famous, right? By the way, just I need to mention this because this week, it's this week's parasha talks about the time when Aaron passed away. It's the only time in the Torah that it records the date and of the death of someone. Only time in the entire Torah. Like we know when Moshe Rabbeinu died, we know other people also from oral tradition and so on, Midrashim, but Aaron was the only one, and we read it this week's parasha. We do this come on Shabbos. It's the first of Av. So this year we actually read it on Aaron's yard site, which is fascinating. Okay, Aaron's a whole other story. He was a person of peace, person of unity. He was an amazing person. But he was the high priest. And Korach said, well, why can't I be a high priest? And you know what Moshe Rabbeinu said? Moshe Rabbeinu said, Afani, I also want to be a high priest. I really have that ambition. I really have that aspiration. But in this case, we can't because God decided there's only one. And there's our roles for different people. And that's Aaron's role, not yours and not mine. So we call the Parsha Korach because the essential ambition is good. The essential ambition. But not when it's fueled by ego. Ambition is a sense, it's a very strong expression of self. But it's got to be bought, acquired by sheep. It's like the ox, but it's got to be acquired by sheep, right? Same thing with everything. Like in relation with the idea of giving, right? So if giving, again, giving or helping or being firm. We talked about parenting before. When I made that comment, this is what I meant. Obviously, it cannot be based on ego because it's not about me. So if my child is doing something wrong and I get harsh with him and put him down and scream, that's not a good idea either. Because that's just about me. I'm feeling upset. It's a firmness which evolves and derails into ego, into anger, into harshness, into a damaging way of disciplining because it's about me. But that doesn't mean that you go to the, we always suffer, we talk about it so many times. Society suffers from the pendulum syndrome. So we didn't like the harshness of some people that we knew, so therefore we don't change, we change it now to this gentle stuff. Right? We can't tell anything. Like, I heard a podcast, I gotta tell you, it's unbelievable. I heard a podcast once, I get very fired up with this stuff, but I heard a podcast once of a lady speaking, she's talking to a cousin of hers, having a discussion, and talking about how they were brought up and their parenting. She's into this all this parenting stuff, this gentle parenting stuff. So she says, you know, when my grandson comes and he's jumping on my couch, so you know, I don't do what was done to me. I don't just say, get off the couch. I go over to him and I say, I see you want to jump. Maybe we should go outside the backyard, we'll jump together. Are you kidding? Kids are born wanting to do naughty things, and that's perfectly normal. And if they didn't want to do, I'd be worried, because it means they're not normal. And me as a parent, I would go up and say, but that's just the thing, right? Because she's talking about the time she got screamed. You don't have to scream, but you can be firm. And I certainly wouldn't go to my grandchild and say, I know you need to jump. Let's channel it in the backyard. You're kidding. I'm busy. I got something to do. But I certainly would walk up and say nicely, but very firmly, we don't jump on couches. Off. Quite okay. Obviously, as long as it's balanced also with love and all the rest of the things. Right? Not only I would say, I have said. And I'm not planning to change even after that podcast. Right? I did learn as a parent that screaming is not a good thing. Being angry is not a good thing, because that's about me. And it's not about me. It's got to be based on ego negation. That's the challenge here. But firmness is important. But the firmness has to be acquired by the sheep. This is the point, right? The ox has to be acquired by the sheep. And so it's the same thing with everything. I just saw recently such a beautiful, beautiful story. There was a, before the war, in Dvinsk, in the town of Dvinsk, there was a very famous, I mean, if you're in the world of Talmud, there was a very, very famous Talmudist who was a very unique individual. He was born in the town of Rogachov, and that's why he became known as the Rogachover. His name was Rabbi Yosef Rosen. He was a genius beyond anyone in his generation. He was like the craziest genius. And it showed in his personality. He was a great rabbi, but he would pace a lot, and he was always learning, and he had books in his... They used to describe him when he was at home, he would have books in all different corners of his living room, and he would jump from one to the other. He was always thinking and always learning and always analyzing. He wrote the most extensive amount of responsa, and so unfortunately a lot of it was burned and captured in the Holocaust, but he was an unbelievable person. And recently I read a biography on him, a fascinating biography, and I learned something new about him, which is I find fascinating. He says that he's... stature and his level in Torah learning and Talmudic analysis, he attributes to his cheder teacher. Why is cheder teacher? Because what happened was, he says, when he was in cheder, he was an impossible child. You know, you get the real genius in your class, impossible to teach. So he would run out of class, right? And he would run out of class when he was 4 or 5 years old, and he would climb the tree, right? So what did the teacher do? This is when you don't have ego, right? If it's about, he climbed the tree. Yeah, exactly what happened. He climbed the tree with him, and he taught him on the tree. And he said, if that teacher would have just screamed at me and slapped me down, and you know, but he wasn't going to give up on him. Like, he said, no, you have to learn. You climb the tree, I'll climb up. Why? But that was not every kid climb the tree. That's not a recipe for having classrooms on top of trees. But it is. An amazing insight to see another, to not have ego. Because the teacher knew it's not about me, it's not about him disturbing my class. I see something special there. I see a talent. I see something that doesn't fit into the classroom learning. And I'm going to go up the tree and teach him. And he did. And he said, if it wouldn't be for him, I would have been a nothing today. I would have been a crazy person without the genius. So that's the concept. The concept is starting point, we need both things. We need ego negation and we need self. But the starting point is ego negation. That it's not about me. It's about the relationship. It's about what's good for someone else. And what's good for someone else might be me being creative. It might be offering something that the person doesn't understand. Me pointing out this thing. That might be criticism. We'll talk about next week, practical, what that means, right? And all sorts of unbelievable lessons of how we give positive feedback or positive or even constructive criticism, right? All that kind of stuff, because sometimes that is necessary. We also have needs. We need to express them. Everyone has needs and wants and all kinds of things they need to express. But it's always about having the other person in mind. I might love to give, but I need to stop and say, 1 second. Is this the right time to give to the other person? Does the other person want to be given now? Want to receive that? Is it going to be good for the person what I want to give? So all that expression of self is really good, but it always comes with accommodating the other person, being aware of the other person, considering the other person. In other words, making room for another. I wanted to go back to the Korach story because I'll share with you an insight that I saw once, a beautiful story. A beautiful idea in one of the Hasidic master's books, and he says like this. Just I want to go back to that story. Because after the Korach story, Korach had 250 people with him who were also rebelling against Moses. And Moses said to him, listen, you want to be the high priest? You can't, there's only one high priest. So you want to test it? Let's do this tomorrow. Tomorrow you'll take pans, metal pans, and you'll bring incense in the Holy of Holies, in the holiest spot of the Mishkan, something that really only the Kohen Gadol could do. But you want to try it? Let's try it. And you do, okay. So they did. The next morning, a fire came out of heaven and consumed them all, killed them all. God punished them because that was wrong. They weren't supposed to do that. But then the fascinating thing is like this. The Jews had this Mishkan, right? They had this tabernacle in the desert. And God tells Moses the next morning, I want you to take all those pans. You know those pans that they all brought the wrong evil ketoret with, the incense they weren't supposed to do? Take them, melt them down, and make them create a cover for the altar. The altar that they used to bring sacrifices to God every single day. In the Mishkan, which in the desert was like an earthenware, it was made out of earth actually and clay, and make this cover for the altar. So the Maor of Ashemesh, a great Hasidic master in Poland, he asked the question, he says, that's really strange. You would take 250, the altar was a holy utensil. It was a place where they would bring offerings, flower offerings, animal offerings to God. They would sit, I'm not going to the whole offering story now, but it was considered a holy ritual. And what are you going to do? They're going to always go on the pans of these bad people who did the wrong thing with those pans? Why would you do that? And he says an amazing thing, the same thing I said before. He said the fact that they wanted to use the pan to bring incense, the aspiration was good. But they lacked humility to know their place. And I want the Jewish people to know that, says God. Aspiration is good. You should want to. The Talmud says that competition between scholars increases wisdom. You see someone that's a greater scholar than you, be ambitious. Try to emulate them. That's a good thing. But you have to have humility. We know that one of the symbols of humility is earth. In Kabbalah always, we find that afar, earth, dust. Abraham said about himself, I am dust, he said, when he was talking to God, when he was confronting him about the Sodom. He came with humility. Same interesting example also. He advocated for the people of Sodom not to be destroyed. And he was bold and he was strong with God, but he said, I'm humble. And he was humble. It's coming from a place of humility because I care about them. And he said then, I am afar, I am dust. Says the Ma'arav HaShamash, that's what God wanted to say. The pans are bad because the pans are a symbol of ambition without humility. But when you melt them down and you put them on top of the earth, the clay of the altar, and you have the combination of humility being the foundation of your ambition, it's good. And that's what you need to do. So I want to just finish with two things. First of all, people always ask, well, that's very good, but how about if I'm working on that and getting my ego, but the other person isn't? Okay, it's always a question. But and sometimes that's the fact, and sometimes relationships do need to end, that unfortunately. But we also need to entertain the rule that often when we work on making space for other people, there's a reciprocal reaction often that comes back, and it breeds. It's contagious. Humility is contagious in an environment. People, when they feel accommodated, they feel understood, they tend to want to understand others as well. Not always, but that's certainly a thing we have to bear in mind. But I want to just end with a famous story of the Talmud that I've told many times, because it's the same idea and the same insight. And that is the story of where we are now in the calendar, the 3 weeks. The 3 weeks is the time we mourn the destruction of the temple. And we are told in the Talmud that the second temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred. But what does it mean, baseless hatred? Right? Everyone always has a reason why they hate the other person. No one will tell you. No one's going to say, you know, I hate that person just because I hate that person. They'll always have a reason, right? So what does baseless hatred mean? Essentially it means there's a reason, but the reason came later. The reason evolved from ego. So let's have a look at the story that Talmud tells, a famous story. Oh, I've been forgetting to do this. Look at that. There we are. Oh, this is the story. Famous story of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. Talmudic story. The Talmud says Then we come to Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which is this Sunday a week, and we mourn the destruction of the temples. The Talmud tells us that Jerusalem and the second temple under the Roman rule was destroyed because of the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. What's that? Says the Talmud the following story. There was a very, very great wealthy man and a very important big macher in Jerusalem. And he had a very, very close friend whose name was Kamsa. Okay. Now it sounds random. Why you need to know the name? Okay, we'll see. But the problem is he had a very big enemy called Bar Kamsa. That's what happened. Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. And this very big machi made a big banquet one day. Called all his friends and some of the great rabbis even were there and so on and so forth. And he sent his attendant. He had an assistant. He said, here's an invitation. Please go invite Kamsa. And the attendant made a mistake. And instead of inviting Kamsa, he invited Bar Kamsa. Okay? This is a beautiful story. This was a fascinating story we used to have as kids. We used to have the story. It was like a fascinating story. Things don't change. Levi was telling Melech, my grandson, the story the other day. He was fascinated by the story. He wanted to see it in the Talmud. So he had to open up a Talmud and show him where it is in the Talmud. Okay. So Bar Kamsa arrives and the room is full. And the big macher walks in and he sees his enemy there and he screams in front of everyone, get out. And the guy is humiliated, right? He says, do me a favor, please don't throw me out. I will pay for my own meal. Get out. He said, I'll pay for half the banquet. Get out. We'll pay for the whole banquet. He says, I don't care. Out. And what happened was, he felt so humiliated that the whole story ended up going to the Roman general who was in charge of Jerusalem, said something about the Jews, proved himself, and the general decided to come and attack. And ultimately that led to the destruction of Jerusalem. So the famous question on the story is the following. The Talmud says Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. It wasn't destroyed because of Kamsa. He wasn't even in the picture. He wasn't even invited. He didn't even know about the whole story. I should have said Jerusalem was... Okay, that's not really such a big question because obviously it's contextually it means it was destroyed because of the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. But it wasn't Kamsa's fault. It was destroyed because of the wealthy guy and Bar Kamsa. So I once saw a beautiful idea that actually the names are very important here. It wasn't about the people Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. What does the word Kamsa actually mean? It's an Aramaic word. So Kamsa means a grasshopper. Now, what's that got to do, right? A grasshopper. That's what it means. Now, what's that got to do with it? So you know the story in the Torah when Moses sends spies to... Right? Spies. And they go and they see giants in Israel and they come back with a very bad report. They say something very interesting. They say that we saw giants there and they viewed us as grasshoppers. In other words, something so small, like nothing. And that's how we felt. And you know what? The Chumash has an Aramaic translation. And when it says grasshoppers, it translates it as kamatzin, same word as kamtza. Insecurity, which leads to ego. Because, so the Talmud is saying, because of Kamsa, and everything that comes from Kamsa, like Bar Kamsa, the son of Kamsa, right? When you have insecurity and you have ego, and then you're obsessed and worried about yourself the entire day, that's what destroys Jerusalem. Because it's a bizarre story. Maybe he had a reason to be angry with Bar Kamsa. Maybe something happened, I don't know. And yet the Talmud refers to it as baseless hatred. Why? Because when you need to humiliate someone in front of a whole crowd and dig your heels in, and you can't just say, okay, I'll leave you here, but just don't say anything and behave yourself. Just stay and I don't, you know, in order not to shame and humiliate the person, that's kamsa. It comes from a deep insecurity, which is the source and origin of real ego. If you had no ego, you would have thought about him, another person, even another person who hurt him, who he can't stand, who he hate. You don't have to invite everyone, that's fine. You don't invite him, that's okay. But don't humiliate him. Don't shame him. Don't create a discord and disunity by shaming a person in front of everyone else. And the commentary say that even the important people, even the religious people were sitting there, Bar Kamsa was really upset that no one said anything. It wasn't just the host. No one stood up. No one said, don't humiliate the person. That's all baseless hatred. Baseless hatred means hatred that comes because I am not prepared to make space for something beyond myself. The basis of every relationship has to be humility. It's ego negation. And the point I wanted to make today is it doesn't mean that there's no strength. It doesn't mean there's no sense of self. Sense of self is critical for relationships. But that sense of self must be an outcome of your humility, not an outcome of your ego. It must be the donkey must be acquired by the sheep. And when that happens, when that's the formula, the Jacob sheep formula, where the basis is always everything I do, everything, even when I'm strong, I think to myself, how's it going to be received by the other? And I don't want to just talk about myself. I don't want to just express my anger or frustration. It's about how's it going to help the relationship. Then the strength is good, but it'll be done with humility. The firmness is good, but it comes from humility. And it takes into account and it considers the other person. That's what makes a strong relationship. So that's that's what brings respect as well. All the things we talked about last time, respect and real love and communication, all those things. Because communication, when does it go wrong? It also goes wrong when it comes from ego. Because when you talk to someone else, but it's coming just to you, you know, we said this before, you're just broadcasting yourself, then it's normally just creates disconnection rather than connection. And doesn't bring to giving, it doesn't strengthen relationship. Whereas strong communication, even harsh communication, like hard communication, when it comes from the sense of humility of how am I going to connect to the other person? I want this to bring a connection, not a disconnection. I want to bring us closer together, not further apart from each other. And I do that in a context. In other words, my communication and my expression of self, but my expression of self or what I want to share is coming from humility, a consideration of you, not just me. It's good communication and it becomes connecting rather than disconnecting. So that's the theory. Next week, we're going to try and take this and translate it into some really, really important practical ideas. Have a wonderful week.